This is Mary Flynn sitting in the Blackbird office in Richmond, Virginia with sculptor Myron Helfgott, whose work appears in the current gallery section. But it always has interested me how the things that sort of you put into your hopper, mm-hmm. kind of, which is like Nabokov's work. What artists, besides the novelists that you were mentioning, what artists, and you might comment a little bit about your fondness for Duchamp in that sense.
I was talking to a good friend, Richard again, Caroline, and both of us, he's a modernist, I'm not an anti-modernist, but I don't trust it so much, modernism, anymore. So we come to art from very different directions, and we both think that Marcel Duchamp is the most important artist of the 20th century, either of us without question. There's so much of the vocabulary that he's suggested. He doesn't tell you anything. He's unbelievable as a reporter. He doesn't tell you much about what he's thinking, what he's doing. He's a great planner in as much as he planned to have all his work in the museum, and there they are in the museum. And they're still vital because we don't know about them. But he obviously is somebody, because he's so unique, you can't mimic what he's done, but all you do is carry that spirit around, that vital spirit. I'm reading about Duchamp, and I find that my mind is just rolling. I'm very active, that he generates a lot of ideas for me.
He does seem to be very open-ended in comparison to somebody like Picasso.
Picasso, you know, Picasso, when David Smith died, and there was one whole issue of one of the art magazines was given over to David Smith, and all his friends wrote about him. And the one thing they agreed upon with David Smith is that he wasn't a very good sculptor. But the only reason he made good sculptures is because he made so many of them. And he made an enormous amount of sculptures. And I think Picasso did a lot of bad paintings. You know, I think maybe Guernica might be one of the bad paintings, but he did some brilliant things. And he was very smart in how he presented these things. But Picasso, he doesn't hold the fascination for me, and Cubism doesn't hold the fascination for me that other people do. I mean, El Greco, I have an infinite amount of interest in fascination by his works. Cézanne, I'm totally fascinated by his paintings. I was fortunate to be in Paris when the largest Cézanne retrospective show there ever was, and they had a transit strike, so nobody could get to the show. And I was in walking distance, and I walked there, and here the place is empty, and I'm looking at this enormous Cézanne show by myself. So I was able to stand in front of all these paintings by myself and just look, and stand there and look uninterrupted and not worry about the ambiance and crowd. And I finished that visit and realized that every painting there, that if you looked at it long enough, there's something that's going to shock you about the painting.
I was thinking that both of those artists and Duchamp all have a fairly edgy relationship with reality, and that it's very shifty in that sense.
Oh, that some of the El Greco paintings, after 1600, they are just amazing. I still can't come to grips with them. I was sitting at the National Collection a couple of years ago, and there's a painting there that I'd seen many, many, many times. I was looking at it, and I couldn't believe what I saw. He had this little part of it where it was just a little shocking event. And so I keep discovering these things in these paintings. Picasso, not so much. I mean, I don't want to be a heretic about it, but he doesn't hold the fascination for me that some of these other people do. It's amazing. I'm not talking about more sculptors, isn't it?
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I haven't observed your work. But are there sculptors who also fit in there, or did you come into sculpture through architecture?
I didn't. I didn't know anything about art when I got into art. This was quite accidental. I got into architecture accidentally too, and actually loved it. But the only reason we're calling the things I do now sculpture is because I say they are. Aside from that, I don't think anybody else would call them sculpture. I mean, I'm not sure what they would call them. But there are a lot of people that interest me for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. I look at Martin Puryear's work, and they're elegant. They're just exquisitely made. For me, there are these wonderful archetypal images that he makes. There's Tony Craig. There's many of these things that I find fascinating. Other things less fascinating. Yeah, there are some people out there that I really enjoy.
But thinking back to 30 years ago, thinking of other work you've made, the things that you sort of real objects that you made out of lead.
Yes.
Little sort of stage sets,
right,
almost.
Right.
Were there sculptors that you were looking at along through that period that sort of interested you or influenced you?
One of the biggest shifts is my increasing disinterest in the aestheticized object. I just don't care about it anymore. So I go to the museums and look at these things, and I'm less and less and less interested in them. So as much as I attempt to take some of these issues out of my work, it's impossible to remove it all. But that's the difference. It's just not, I just don't care about some of those things. I don't want to spend the time to think about where do I put, should I put this here or should I put it over here? I don't care. Should it be a red one or should it be a green? I don't care.
In that sense, I guess Duchamp continues to speak to you there, because the aestheticized object sort of frequently disappeared from his work too.
He was amazing, though. One thing you don't hear too much, we talk about Duchamp, is the craftsmanship. These things were so spectacular, so immaculately done, and they're so good, they're hidden, because you don't even notice the craftsmanship. And things he couldn't do himself, he hired other people to do, to build for him, the little urinals, these miniature urinals in the box in the valise, he hired somebody else to do. In the, maybe the last painting he ever did, there's a hand in it, and he hired a sign painter to paint the hand in this, in the painting, because he wanted it perfect, like a sign painter's hand. But everything is perfect. Everything is just perfect. In fact, a friend of mine was over yesterday looking at my work, and she said, have you thought about making these things a little cleaner? Because now I just glue a bunch of pieces of paper together that actually I posterized a large photograph. So there's a grid pattern that's set up because the pieces are glued together. I said, yeah, I've thought about it, but it's going to be too nice, and I want the work to be a little rustic and get in your way as you're trying to look. You don't look, can't look through it. You have to look at it also. So, is that a contradiction?
No, maybe, but so what?
Yeah, right.
That contradiction in your work would not surprise me, because some of it always strikes me as saying on this hand and on the other hand.
Yeah.
But there is a conversation sometimes that goes on in it in that way.
Well, I hope so, because A, I don't know what I want to do. And one makes the work to find out what one wants to do. And then more often than not, hopefully that there's an internal conflict that you work at resolving. And if you resolve, probably the work is then not very good. So when you finish the work, if this internal conflict remains, then you probably have something that's going to be fairly vital within this, that in the work itself. So the conflict, you know, the conceptual conflicts or pictorial conflicts or whatever they are that are going on there, that I think give the work its life. So one hopes that I don't find the answer. And
thinking a little bit about what you were saying, and Donald Cuspet, who was here lecturing last week and who will be lucky enough to have that lecture, I think, in the May Blackbird, was talking about a quote he brought from William Gass about the permanent avant-garde.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Which was one of those little intriguing things. Who is in it? And it usually is something, thinking what you were saying about that surprises or shocks you or that remains open-ended.
Yeah, remains open. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Duchamp is always that way. That's never close, and nobody can ever close it. I mean, I can't think of any of his work that has been, except maybe things like New Descending the Staircase, those early paintings that he was doing. But beyond that, you get into about 1912, and everything after that is, you know, you throw up your hands. You have no idea what this is about. Just fascinated by it. And people have written these wonderful treatises on the large glass and the Tome d'Aunay, and it still doesn't answer the questions.
Do places mean a great deal, something to you in terms of how you work? I know you spend a lot of time in Paris.
Uh-huh. The French aren't really part of the avant-garde, and I'm not interested so much in what the French are doing. The Germans, of course, are doing spectacular things, and some of the Italians are doing wonderful things. Germans are doing terrific. Some of the Russians are doing wonderful things. I don't go there because of the art. I go there because I can actually go there cheaply. I do love the wine and the food, and in Paris, it's just a small town that you can actually walk around in this town. And I love taking pictures there because the pictures are so wonderful too. No, not because of the art.
Who is doing work right now that interests you? Who that you've looked at lately around here or in D.C. or New York? Anybody who's caught your eye or who you sort of keep track of?
Yeah, D.C. I don't think has a terrific art scene, I have to say. I think one of the new galleries in D.C. is really trying to do some of the fuse box, and I really enjoy what they're doing. It's a style that's slightly hipper than I am, and so I get, I have to say, I'm an old guy, of course, and I have expectations when I go to look at paintings and sculptures, and that expectation is that it's going to want to invite me back again. And too much of the art I see, I'm not invited back again. I've seen it. There's no reason to revisit it again, and I'm off to see something else. And people have, I think the expectations have changed. The fame for 15 minutes is way too long. Now you've got for less than a minute, you know, you can have somebody's attention and you're off to something else. Recently I saw a show, now deceased artist Paul Tech, and it was, it knocked me out. I've forgotten how much I loved his drawings and paintings. In Richmond, of course, my colleagues, I'm not saying this only because it's politically correct to say it, but I have to say my colleagues, there are some wonderful painters and sculptors in Richmond that I love their work there. I don't see why they're not more famous than they are. Can I go to these other cities? And it's always amazing. You go to New York, and there are some wonderful things. You know, you go to McKee Gallery where they have Martin Perrier, and they've got a number of other wonderful people in that gallery. And I go to some other galleries, and there's some wonderful things. But the great bulk of it is thin. It's just way too thin. It's not that I see it and I don't get it. The problem is I see it and I get it way too easily. And then I look at my colleague's work, and I thought, boy, oh boy.
Who have you been reading lately?
I'm reading some nonfiction. Richard and I were just talking about this book called Formless. It's a series of essays by Yves Lambois and Rosalind Krauss about a show they put together, and it was influenced by Bataille and some of one of the things he had done. And I'm interested in it because Formless having to do without an apparent structure. These things are structureless. And I mean, you think of maybe Pollock paintings, you know, they think of that as in a way formless, but this whole book is about formlessness, which, as I said before, I'm trying to get away from so much of the things of placement that I found it fascinating. And other things go in and out of my head. Nothing, no fiction that I've really been knocked out by lately. I've tried a number of things, but nothing. Again, the Eastern Europeans have been wonderful. Ivan Klima and Love and Garbage was a wonderful book, him just reminiscing about some things and talking. And I love it when the hero in first person, you know, the I, and he begins to talk about things beyond the novel, just whatever, just nature of things, and I find it really intriguing.
Seapall certainly does.
Oh, yeah, of course, the other, of course, and of course, The Immigrants and The Rings of Saturn were. But yeah, those are fascinating. Another one was very influential for me because there's essentially no beginning and no end. I mean, you have this thing that is a flat line. There's nothing exciting happens, and you just kind of move through this thing. He takes his walk and visits places, and then he stops. But it was wonderful, just a knockout. Yeah, I loved it. Those are the two favorite. The other ones, I didn't enjoy them quite as much as those two. The very best. Oh, yeah. Mm. Nagib Mahfouz, I haven't read him for a while, but one of the things that intrigued me, some issues I use with my students, in the introduction to the Cairo trilogy, he said that before he ever started writing the books, he developed a dossier on all the characters in the book, this family, which goes through lives in Cairo from about the turn of the century to about 1950, as I think he writes, about this family. And so he knew the people very well, and so when incidents happened in the book, that he knew how they all were going to react. So my students now think about doing figures. I said, well, who are they? What are they thinking? What are they doing right now? As opposed to making some anonymous figure that has a head and a couple arms and a couple of legs, they're in right in the middle of something very specific, and it allows them to look at the figure more closely. And it seems to pay off.
Does music play any role for you? Or
I would like to say yes, but I don't think so. Although I borrow pieces from composer friends of mine and use in my audio, which I've just done recently. Although my friend doesn't know it, I stretched out the 6.5 minute piece to 7:50. So it's a little slower than he had anticipated it being. No, it doesn't. I mean, it affects me, but it doesn't influence my work in any way, no. Mm-hmm. Mostly literature.
You have a new show and new work coming up here shortly.
Yes, at the Anderson Gallery. two floors, a little scary to fill up two floors of the Anderson Gallery. But I have one piece, the one I said is 60 feet long. We may put that in. Then I have another piece that's, all the visuals are done, all the writing is done, but I haven't recorded it yet. That's 38 feet long. So between the two of them, we can put a big dent in the gallery.
So this will sort of follow logically from the work that's in literary criticism along with the reportings and
yes.
things like that.
Yeah, and there'll be a couple of pieces earlier before I started doing the audio and the kinetic things.
Is this sort of a retrospective?
It's supposed to be, and I'd like to keep the old work, as few of those as possible in the show.
All right, and next year you'll be retired. What are you going to do?
This year I'll be retired.
Yes, this, thinking the next academic year.
Yeah,
but this,
yeah.
As of the summer, you'll be retired.
I'll be retired this summer. What am I going to do? As much as possible, of course. I mean, the only reason I'm retiring is to spend more time in the studio.